I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest is Stephanie Dixon. She's a fashion industry marketeer turned sustainability activist. Her latest venture, Green is the New Black. It's a festival for conscious suppliers and buyers of fashion products and Stephanie's unique attempt to make the fashion industry more accountable. More accountable for what, you ask? Well, a lot, so it turns out. Fashion thrives on fast and frequent shifts in consumer tastes. And to keep pace, brand name makers of clothing and accessories have a habit of using cheap and sometimes unethical labor to drive production. The industry is also a big polluter, the second biggest in the world, according to some. Landfills everywhere are piled high with textile waste and toxic chemicals used to make the fancy things we wear. Stephanie's decision to press for a fashion makeover is where our conversation began. I asked her to say a little bit about how she got to Singapore and what led her to undertake these remarkable initiatives.
I actually grew up in Singapore. I went to high school here. I went to the Australian International School for a couple of years, and then I went and did university, went to Italy for a year, and I came back because I got what at the time was my dream job. So I... So I ran fashion events and festivals around Asia. I always wanted to work in fashion when I was a little girl. It was just something that, you know, it was just drew me. And I love bringing people together. So when I was my family doctor asked me, what do I think I want to do when I grow up, when I finish university? I was like, yeah, I kind of like the idea of doing fashion events. And she knew the founder of Men's Fashion Weeks in Singapore. So she got me connected. And then I started as an intern and I worked my way up. And it really was my dream job at the time. And then there was a moment where I started opening my eyes a little bit more, and I started kind of realizing that actually fashion was a very polluting industry.
And what made you think that? Did something happen, or did you read something, or is it just kind of being close to the industry for a while, it dawned on you there's a problem here?
I wish it was the case that it was the industry, but actually it was more me feeling like I was on autopilot, me feeling like there was something amiss. And then I just started kind of looking around a little bit more and opening my eyes a bit more. And then I came across the documentary, The True Cost, which is basically pulling back the veil in the fashion industry to show what really goes on. And I felt completely blindsided because I'd worked in this industry for around 4 years, or three and a half, four years at that point. And I was like, how did I not know that this was going on? How did I not know that it's such a socially corrupt industry, that it is literally one of the most polluting in the world? I really felt cheated. And I felt like I couldn't continue on the trajectory that I was on, knowing what I'd learned.
Did you sense that being around the industry? Was there a sense of kind of, disposal mentality that was going on? Or was it just something in you that was yearning for perhaps something beyond fashion?
So I think it's a little bit of both. I think there is a huge disposability in fashion, and I definitely got caught up in that whole, you know, shopping online every month, excited for the packages to come and having cheap clothes, so I had more clothes. There was just this burning and yearning inside of me, like this fire that I couldn't quite understand what it was. And that's when I started exploring. So I was like, I feel like I'm missing something here. And then when it came to me, then I realized, okay, yes, this is not, that's why I don't feel this alignment anymore.
How is it polluting? What aspects of fashion are polluting for people who, including myself, who may not know?
Yeah, so basically it's water. It's one of the most water-intensive industries in the world. So for example, a single cotton t-shirt uses around 2,700 liters of water in its production, which is enough that we would drink in a three-year period.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so it's really crazy. Water is a massive thing. Obviously, chemicals being used and then seeping into the land is another big thing. Obviously, the carbon emissions and, you know, it's the whole industry, really. There's lots of different assets to that, but it's definitely one of the top industries when it comes to water usage.
So this is textile manufacturing beyond just fashion, high fashion. We're talking about all aspects of handbags, clothing, anything that goes into to what we wear and live in day in, day out.
Exactly. And I guess once you get into this more, you actually realize that our skin is our biggest organ. And a lot of people, I don't think, actually know that. And so the clothing that you have, if you don't pre-wash it, there's a lot of chemical residue and that kind of thing that then seeps into your skin. And this is something that a lot of people don't think about as well. So
there are health implications.
Absolutely.
And where is most of this manufacturing of clothing, textiles, fashion taking place?
I mean, there's different places around the world. Obviously, there's a lot in China, in Thailand. Now looking at Cambodia and Laos as more factories are moving there as well. But we're actually seeing a lot of factories now ethical factories being built in those places, but also some people are now reverting back to their home countries to get stuff made ethically in a factory that they can go visit in some places in the world.
What is an ethical factory?
Okay, so that basically means that the employees and everyone who are work at the factory are treated fairly. So they're paid above minimum wage on a global scale, depending on the city and the country that they're in. But it basically means that the employees are prioritized. Their health and their well-being is prioritized, and they are looked after in the supply chain.
But what about, as you mentioned earlier, the environment? Is this also ethical factories, those that use less water or fewer chemicals?
Absolutely. So there's different certifications, and there's also some factories that practice certain things that aren't certified, because sometimes the certification can be really expensive. But yes, absolutely. I mean, you look at different factories, they have different things that they've committed to, for example. So some would look at water. Some factories have taken it to have closed loop systems, in a sense that they treat and clean all the water so that it's drinkable when it leaves the factory.
So you became impassioned by this when you discovered the truth. And instead of just leaving the world of fashion and stopping the work you were doing, you pivoted. Can you tell us about that pivot?
It's a great word, pivot.
Toggled. We use toggle, pivot.
No, I love pivot.
All right, we're working with pivot.
So at that point, I quit my job. Oh, I hadn't said that. Sorry. So I quit my job and I started trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do with my life that's going to make me feel like I can use my skill set? I can start using what I'm able to do to come up with some kind of solution or be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem.
Stephanie, you quit cold with no idea of what you're going to do next?
Well, I had an idea, but yes, I did quit cold. I'd saved up about 10 grand, which would have seen me through a few months. So I knew I had a couple of months up my sleeve. And I originally wanted to do a sustainable swimwear line, but I had no idea about manufacturing. I had no idea about design, and it was just too overwhelming. And I felt really lost at the time as well. And I tried to find my community. So I went to a lot of events at this period, as most young aspiring entrepreneurs do. And I felt like at the time they were very business focused, a little preachy sometimes, or I felt a bit intimidated. Maybe I wasn't being preached at, but I didn't feel comfortable in the communities that I was reaching out to in Singapore at the time.
And these are primarily Singapore, and these are people, your classic entrepreneurs, maybe technology startups, not really in the field of what you were doing? Or is it just the nature of the conversation they were having that you weren't comfortable with?
Yeah, so I went to a few female groups and I felt quite intimidated in those groups, I think, because I didn't really know what I was doing. And I think a lot of it was my own projections onto myself, to be honest, on reflection. But at the time I felt like, oh, these people are also successful. And like, what am I doing? And I can't really say, I don't know what I'm doing. And like when I went to sustainability groups, I felt, again, I had no idea because I just literally discovered this whole side of the industry and sustainability. So yeah, it was a bit of a struggle. And then I figured out, okay, you know what? I can't find a place I feel welcome and safe. So I'm going to design that place because surely I'm not the only person that feels this way. And coming from an events background, I thought that would be the best use of my time in the beginning.
So I can't find my community out there. I will create my own and build it from the ground up. That was the idea.
Absolutely.
All right. So where did you start?
So one day I just woke up and I was like, you know what? I'm going to build a conscious community. And to me, that really meant that people who understand that their decisions not only impact them, but their environment and surroundings, but more so that they are on a different kind of level and you want to connect with that like-minded people, but also be really mindful in interactions and feel welcome and safe. So I started a monthly series of events called The Wedge. And basically brought together experts on different topics that weren't being addressed at the time. So we talked about fearless success. We talked about fear. I had one event where we talked about death. And then slowly, you know, I started having these events. We talked about happiness, all these kind of things that I was really struggling with at the time. And then I started on the fashion side doing
this is fascinating. So basically it was just all kinds of wide open topics.
Yeah.
Where you were trying to tap in some of the key themes, concerns, issues, frustrations of folks your age or of all ages or of any gender? I mean, who was your target audience? This is a big, big undertaking, right, to take on all of that. Who did you start with?
It was really targeting people like me because I was struggling in life. I felt lost and confused. And as I said, I couldn't find my community. So I was just thinking, okay, there must be others like me. And I started having conversations with friends and people in my network, and they were struggling with the same things. So
it was a common issue that you discovered through this, even though it might have been part of your social, you know, regimen, that in fact, there are lots and lots of people out there who are trying to come to terms with what it was to work, what it was to engage in the world, and what it was to be meaningful. Is this what you're saying? These are older people kinds of issues, but you, as a group of young people, were starting to contemplate this right off the bat. Why was that? Is this something in the world that shifted, or is this just a group of very conscientious individuals who happened to be living in Singapore?
Again, I think it's a little bit of both. So for me, I kind of had a quarter-life crisis when I quit my job and I didn't want to do that industry anymore. And I was searching for purpose. I was searching for more meaning to actually do something that was going to make a difference. And that's a theme that was very common and still is around the people that I was surrounding myself with and people in Singapore. Because I think as we become more awakened, because we're getting access to more information, we're getting more access to more understanding of how industries are working, how the world's working, the damage that we're doing, people are searching for more, and they're willing to sacrifice money, and they're willing to sacrifice status sometimes as well to find something that actually makes them feel good about what they're doing on a daily basis.
Okay. So is this just idealism of the 20s, this stage in life where anything's possible, or is this something new and unique given the state of affairs in the world and where things are going with technology, environment, and everything else? What do you think?
It's a really big question. I guess I can't speak to what happened before us because I wasn't there.
You've read history books.
Of course. Yeah. But I mean, you know, you never know unless you've experienced something. You can relate, you can try and understand it, but unless you've actually gone through something, you'd never fully deeply understand it. So I think right now, I think it's a generational thing, and that's what I'm reading as well, that people are talking about millennials, and now we're talking about the next generation and how to understand them and what they're going through and how we can, you know, empower them or work with them and get the best out of them. But I think it is, you know, we've obviously had big booms in consumerism, and everyone got this very convenient life. You know, we got access to anything we wanted anytime. And I think now, because we've had everything we could want, or at least, you know, in the first world countries, you can basically get access to what you want. There's a question of, okay, what else? What's more?
So it's tapped out. The model has basically run its course.
Possibly, yeah. I think that's one part of it.
Do you know how terrifying this must be to all the capitalists out there and the, you know, those manufacturers of all these goods and products who without the customer base, the whole system would basically fold in on itself. Do they feel threatened by this, do you suspect?
I hope so.
I'm Steve Stein. You're listening to my conversation with Stephanie Dixon, founder of The Wedge Asia, Singapore's leading conscious community, and Green is the New Black, Asia's first conscious festival with an eye on fashion. I kicked off the second part of our conversation by asking her what happened after she found a way of creating a community of like-minded, socially conscious millennials. What new ideas came to the fore?
Because I loved fashion still, coming from the fashion industry, I started doing a lot of research about brands and finding out their stories, finding out how they were made, where they were made, and just sharing that with people to see if they were interested too.
So it's that guilty pleasure. It's like, I still like ice cream, but I really shouldn't have anything with cream in it.
Yeah, exactly. So I was, trying to figure out where I could spend my money and know that it was going to the right place. Just sharing that with people. And actually, there was a lot of interest, but people were scared, 3-4 years ago to buy stuff online from a brand they didn't know. Obviously, it's a lot changed now. But back then, there was still some hesitance about that. So I thought, okay, I'm an event organizer. I used to run fashion festivals. Surely I can do my own festival where I can bring together brands and just see if it's going to work. So it was all an experiment. Literally at the time, I was like 6 weeks out, came up with the name Green is the New Black because, you know, I come from fashion and that was something we used to say, something is the new black. And obviously we were focused on sustainability. I was very passionate about this topic now. So yeah, literally decided 6 weeks out, let's do an event. Let's bring together 40 brands. We took over a co-working space here called the Working Capital. We just did it and we did one talk and we had about 600 people show up.
These are 40 startup brands never heard of before or little known, just coming into the market?
Yeah. So some of them were established, had been around for a while. Some of them were new. Everything from like a solo entrepreneur to kind of mom pop entrepreneur to people that actually had like a, you know, a team of people as well. So all different kind of stages and some restaurants that were quite well known, but all of them had to have a conscious aspect. And that's why we called it Green is New Black and the Conscious Festival.
So 40 brands and 600 people, that's a movement.
Yeah, I was happy.
Yeah, I mean, and had you anticipated this? Did you have a sense of who might be showing up? Was it gaining ground or was it just a Hail Mary?
I had no idea what to expect. I mean, we literally did the whole thing on a shoestring budget. And we literally just, you know, scampered and hustled and just did the best that we could. And then it worked. So I was like, okay, well, there's obviously a market here and now we can do it bigger and better next year.
So were people then sharing their insights and ideas about what it was to build a brand in a more conscientious world?
Not at that one. So basically that event, we just had one panel discussion on fashion because of course that was still where my head was at. And then a year later, we did our second festival, the Conscious Festival. By then we'd called it that. And we had a whole day of talks. So we did a conscious conference in a sense. And that one we talked about basically more on the communication and storytelling side, as well as how we live consciously as humans, like how we can invest in ourselves so that we can give more. And then we looked at obviously sustainability as well, but did conversations that again, at the time I couldn't find and I couldn't get access to. So we looked at more interesting topics and things that people could take on an individual level in their work, but also their lives.
Not to be a cynic, but you know, I've seen corporations embrace corporate social responsibility, pay lip service to all these great notions of how we should engage with the world, how we need to treat people better, treat the environment better, whatever the case may be. And then you realize it's just that, it's superficial. How do you hold your burgeoning participants accountable for making statements about, you know, conscientious or conscious, you know, adaptation, and then making sure they live it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we basically identified 6 values that we define a conscious brand. And so all the brands that we work with, they need to fulfill at least 2 out of those 6 and be working on more.
Can you tell us those 6?
Yeah, sure. So first is protect the people. Power to the people. And that's all about ethical brands, what we covered a little bit already. The next one is protect the planet. So that's everything that's related to sustainability and all the green aspects, organic, you know, those, it's quite broad, but things that are really focused on the sustainability and looking after Mother Earth. Then we have innovation for good. So companies that are really using their work and their as a force to innovate and literally come up with solutions for big issues. Then we have pro-animal life. So products that are not, you know, obviously any animal cruelty, that they're vegan. There's that. Then well for your being is all around the wellness piece because, as I said, conscious living really starts with us, so we have to look after ourselves.
And the last one?
Crystal clear, which is all around transparency.
Okay.
So there's those 6 values.
Around transparency in terms of reporting or divulging what's going on, how you're producing, and really being accountable for all the previous 5.
Exactly. So that's where you actually are transparent and you are clear and open with what's going on behind the scenes.
How do you take this global? There are other conscientious organizations out there that are trying to build up like-minded groups and entities. Are you connected with them or do you find reasons and purpose to get together with them either through digital means or other?
Definitely. So there are some amazing corporations around the world and movements as well. So some of them we're connected to already. And we're very collaborative in the way that we work. So at our festivals and the content that we create, we're always supporting other movers and shakers in the space. And vice versa, they support us back. So very much in Singapore and Hong Kong, which is our 2 key markets at the moment, we are connected to all the groups there. And then we're connected to some of the global groups as well. And I guess it's about sometimes we fly them in for our events, or we'll share the stuff they're doing, we'll, you know, promote it. And a lot of them, I'm also fangirling about the work that they're doing and I haven't quite reached out or connected fully yet. But it's great because the more as I'm sure you understand as a master networker yourself, the more you get into these kind of industries, the more doors open and you get connected to the people that you want to be connected to. And I think a lot of it's about timing. So if I haven't connected to them yet, I know that I will at some point.
What role, therefore, and maybe let's talk about in some detail, does social media play in this whole endeavor?
Social media is critical for us. And I think it's also critical for the brands that we follow and we want to support and we want to meet. Because that allows you to cut boundaries and borders. And it allows you to connect with people outside of your immediate circles, outside of your city, your country, and find people that are actually on the same wavelength as you. So I think social media is great. It's a fantastic tool. It allows us to also communicate and follow and share each other's work very fast. And it allows consumers and individuals to get information so much faster than we would have ever been able to do before.
You know, what does it take? Is it a tipping point you're looking for? Economies of scale, when at some point that all these kind of relatively unknown brands start to rise in the minds of young buyers, maybe not young buyers, any buyer, so that it starts to displace the major brands and therefore forces the major brands to follow suit?
I think it's a little bit of both. Firstly, of course, you know, the more that everybody votes with their time and their wallets for brands that are making a difference, the more that we are going to get the economies of scales, we're going to reach that tipping point. But I think it's also important to put that pressure on the bigger brands to do better and to be more accountable and to actually take responsibility for the damage that they're doing on the planet and to the resources and to individuals as well. And I think that it's a collective effort. It's going to take policy from governments. It's going to take pressure from consumers and individuals, and it's going to take the corporations and the private sector as well. This is, you know, for us to get out of the climate catastrophe that we're heading towards. I'm sure you've heard about the IPCC report that came out a few weeks ago, 12 years. It's going to take a global effort, and it's going to take every single group and companies and governments to get involved in this. And the sooner we can do that, the better.
Are fashion brands legitimately responding to this call to action, in your opinion?
So there are, it's interesting because I think some are doing it on their own accord. So there are some big players who have made very audacious goals about becoming more circular, for example, or recycling everything that they produce or having systems in place to at least recycle the same amount that they're producing. So there are some big audacious goals that are very aspiring. Let's see if they hit them.
Which ones, for instance?
Well, okay, so it's a very brand that I wouldn't want to promote because I don't fully believe on the ethical.
Fair enough.
Ethical, right. But they have come out and made goals, and I can share it with you if you really want.
No, it's okay. I like your response. That's fine. So tell me more about that. And how does, if they are starting to respond to try to be, as you say, closed loop, so not do any more damage than they cause in the world, or at least, you know, restore to some degree or become recycling focused, how many of those organizations as a percentage are doing that, and how much more has to happen in short order in order to make a difference?
So I think there are definitely some players that are leading the way, and you can very easily find out who they are. There are others that are just coming out with random statements because they feel like they have to say something, and some that aren't doing anything at all. So I think in fashion in particular, it's not nearly enough. However, there are changes happening. And I mean, I'm sure you came across the Burberry scandal a few months ago where they burnt millions of dollars worth of their stuff because they couldn't sell it or they didn't want to sell it.
Right.
That kind of stuff blows up in social media. So also going back to the social media piece, that blew up. And now they are literally coming out and they're going to be changing that whole process. But again, previously, we would have never had access to that information. So the more this kind of stuff blows up, the more brands have to be more transparent. They have to be more responsible because the global pressure that they're feeling. So I think we're definitely moving in the right direction. I don't think it's happening fast enough.
They say that ultimately the power resides with the consumer. You vote with your pocketbook and or your wallet or whatever the case may be. And with that, you then start to shift the delivery or the capabilities or the behaviors of corporations. We're talking about a massive industry with lots of consumers around the world who really aren't environmentally conscious at this stage. They just want that Gucci bag. And that's kind of all, you know, they think about. Don't you need to equally focus on trying to retrain the thinking of the consumer?
Definitely. I mean, that's a lot of the work that we do is around raising awareness and education, but doing that in a mainstream way that people don't feel preached to and they don't feel bad for their choices. But instead, we celebrate the good. We say you can take little green steps in your daily life to reduce your impact. And I think, yeah, a lot of it does come around down to education, but the brands are just as much responsible for that as consumers. So I think, yes, you know, brands are always going to say, it's you guys, if you don't want this stuff, stop buying it. Like, we'll stop producing it when you stop buying it. But I think brands are just as much responsible to changing the direction of it. They just, there's, unfortunately, there's not that many that I've come across that are willing to be bold enough to do that yet. And I think the other big part in this is individuals who are very passionate and they have the resources in corporate companies to become entrepreneurs, to become change makers within companies and do the change from the inside out. And I think that is a huge opportunity that I speak about a lot because I want more people to think about it. You don't need to quit your job and become an entrepreneur. You can make massive change from within and be one of the leading voices within a company to start making better choices.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. You've just heard my conversation with Stephanie Dixon, founder of The Wedge Asia, a Singapore-based conscious community, and Green is the New Black, an annual event showcasing fashion companies committed to sustainable practices and products. So it is with our Asia Insider Minute that I'll try to sum up the key takeaways from the conversation you just heard. While the focus was on fashion this episode, Stephanie speaks to a higher purpose, one that supersedes any specific industry and speaks to the relationship that her generation has with corporations, big brands, and sustainability. She's younger than me, of course, and a member of the generation that has come to be known as the millennials. As always, it's possible to overstate what separates generations, but I felt it strongly and not in a bad way during our conversation. She is, to use her own term for it, woke, and what that means is that she is, first and foremost, a conscious consumer. In the same way, Stephanie had what she describes as a quarter-life crisis, one in which she felt an absence of meaning, a lack of direction. She did the only thing she could think to do. She created a community, and with it, a way of building common purpose. It gave her direction. For Stephanie, that awakening, that refusal of the status quo, had also to do with a refusal to turn a blind eye to the environmental and labor abuses that were taken for granted, that were understood as necessary in the fashion industry. The important thing is to realize that she's not alone. There are hundreds of thousands of millennials entering the workforce each year, and from all corners of the globe. There's a consciousness and an intent on asking the questions that for years have been understood as unaskable. I think of my own generation and how we assumed there would be trade-offs. Making high-quality products at low prices means using resources and lots of it. But that's capitalism, right? Wrong. Companies that once shrank behind PR smokescreens and opaque regulations are suddenly and thankfully being held accountable, not by institutions, but by people like Stephanie who, armed with easy access to information and social media, are able to promote or condemn bad behavior on the fly. I think about the abuses of power in my jaded, late-in-life way. I say, find the bastards, shut them down, make them pay. Not Stephanie. She's not looking to overturn capitalism. She wants to wake it up. And as she sees it, one of the key ways to do this is to set an example, inspire change, and then enlist fashion industry heavyweights to join in. It's a kind of co-opting through kindness. Clever, right? Was I struck by Stephanie's youthful optimism? Yes, I was. But that's not the point. Her plan has less to do with innocence and idealism and more to do with sound principles of group psychology. This is no Woodstock movement where a generation of free spirits head out to Yasker's farm to free their souls and thumb their noses at the status quo. No, this is a movement of educated and outspoken professionals more interested in building up what we have rather than tearing down all we've got. Armed with smartphones and clarity of purpose, this generation will use the tools of capitalism's making to make the capitalists accountable. It's happening now, and will most assuredly happen in the days ahead. The decision we, the elders, have to make is whether to remain silently outraged or give over to a new way, a millennial way, of demanding change than actually doing something about it. It's a new breed of activism with universal implications. Time to get on board. As always, thanks for listening. Until next episode, this is Steve Stein saying, come in from the outside on Inside Asia.